This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Here's where we are. Some trade, a little tourism, and then we go to the movies. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City today, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 27th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Stop me if you've heard this one before, would you? But there is some trade stuff going on in this economy, about which two items to get us going today. Item the first, the trade gap, the trade deficit, it is sometimes called, one of President Trump's economic bete noirs. It increased in August, the third month in a row that the value of what we buy from overseas versus what we sell abroad has gone up. So there is that. Item two, global economic growth. The World Trade Organization said today that the ongoing trade stuff in this economy and elsewhere is going to shave a half a percentage point off global economic growth next year. But the future isn't looking too bright for the WTO itself either. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what's going on there.
There's part of the World Trade Organization that you can think of as a Supreme Court for trade issues. The Trump administration is blocking what are the equivalent of judges from being appointed or reappointed.
Some people have called this basically asphyxiation.
Rachel Brewster teaches international economic law at Duke. This Supreme Court of Trade normally has 7 judges. In a few days, it'll only have 3. In a year or so, it'll only have 2, at which point it won't be able to rule at all.
You're hoping to kill it off by simply depriving it of members.
No Supreme Court for trade, no way to settle trade fights other than just countries fighting it out Wild West style. The WTO becomes dysfunctional. The question is whether this is the goal of the administration or if this is simply leverage to achieve reform.
Depends which Trump official you talk to. I mean, that's one of the problems.
Robert Manning is senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He says some in the administration want to blow up the WTO entirely. Others want to reform it.
The administration has a lot of valid criticisms. Let's give Trump a little bit of credit here. I think he may be doing the world a favor.
Europe and Japan have brought up modest reforms in an apparent effort to address some U.S. concerns. Rufus Yerxa is head of the National Foreign Trade Council. He believes the Trump administration won't be satisfied until the WTO is simply removed as a major player in global trade disputes.
I mean, for U.S. business right now, this is just massive uncertainty.
If the rule of law is breaking down and we are entering an era of economic nationalism, he says, other trading partners could unite against the U.S. and U.S. businesses would be caught in between. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
President Trump, as we and others have reported, holds no fondness for multilateral trade deals. He's a one-on-one negotiations kind of guy. And to that end, Japan has decided to meet the president where he is. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has decided, after declining for a year or more, to start talking with the United States about a bilateral trade deal. But in return, Abe got something he very much wanted, a promise of no increase in American tariffs on Japanese cars during negotiations. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
President Trump has rocked major trade relationships since he took office, renegotiating NAFTA and scrapping the Trans-Pacific Partnership, says Cornell economist Ishwar Prasad.
Trump seems to be pursuing a divide-and-rule strategy, preferring bilateral rather than multilateral deals.
A one-on-one trade deal is not Japan's first choice, says Fred Bergsten at the Peterson Institute. But Japan's steel and aluminum exports have already been hit with punitive tariffs, and
there's a major threat out there, auto tariffs. Japan is still by far the biggest exporter of automobiles to us.
Bergsten says avoiding the auto tariffs bolsters Japan's economy and its strategic alliance with the U.S. The U.S. side wants to reduce the trade imbalance. We have a $13 billion surplus in services with Japan and a $69 billion deficit in goods. Sheila Smith at the Council on Foreign Relations says a bilateral deal might further open Japan's market.
there are some things that the United States would like to sell more of, pork and rice and sugar and things like that.
Smith says there's something in the U.S. that Japan could offer.
Getting Japanese auto producers to beef up their factories, create more jobs.
Showing that whatever our trade deficit with Japan might be on paper, Japanese companies are contributing income to workers here. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Okay, now to real estate and a different way to sell a house. Go to a website, plug in your address, answer a couple of questions about the house, and then wait 24 hours or so to see whether you get a cash offer. There's a handful of companies that are buying up houses that way, including Zillow. The biggest, though, is San Francisco-based Open Door, which just pulled in a $400 million investment from the Japanese conglomerate SoftBank. It does seem, yes, like just another one of those digital disruption things, but as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports now from WESA in Pittsburgh, disrupting real estate might not be so easy.
It's kind of a drag selling a house. Listing, cleaning, staging, but for a fee of about 6.5%, a company like Open Door allows you to bypass that hassle. The company buys a house from you, then turns around and sells it. Shaw Lupton, a real estate analyst with CoStar, says the industry is ripe for change.
I think there are some problems in real estate that technology can solve.
Like the lack of a lot of options to listing your home with a traditional realtor, which can be slow. But Guy Allen, a real estate agent in Northern Virginia, says there's something companies like internet-based Open Door cannot offer.
Understanding the whole process, is sort of very important, and they need a person to talk to and guide them through it.
Not everyone wants so much hand-holding. Some sellers just want to be done and move on. Julia DeWall with Open Door says her company is just following what other industry disruptors like Uber and Lyft have done.
We're just kind of riding the coattails of a lot of other online experiences that have come before us.
Buying up lots of homes across the country does have an element of risk, says Chester Spatt, a finance professor at Carnegie Mellon University. The real estate market could go south.
To some degree, that's exactly what happened during the financial crisis to traditional banks that were in the securitization business.
Open Door is operating in 19 cities, including Chicago, Atlanta, and Los Angeles. And within 2 years, it plans to be in 50 American cities. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
A nod now to the other news of the day. Pity the IT staffs in offices across the country on this Thursday. As just one example, the chief information officer at the Department of Housing and Urban Development in Washington sent this email to HUD staff today. Quote, the high interest in the live Supreme Court nomination hearing has negatively impacted HUD's network and business operations. And he went on to say, in essence, cut it out, stop watching before I have to shut the whole thing down, will you? Also, late this afternoon, news from the Securities and Exchange Commission. They are suing Elon Musk and Tesla, the company of which Musk is the CEO, for fraud. It all goes back to that tweet about taking Tesla private and funding secured at $420 a share. Speaking of Tesla shares, down 10%+ after hours. During hours on Wall Street today? Better. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been 10 years this year, actually 10 years this month, since the financial crisis became real for most Americans. And we've been marking the past decade and what it did to this economy and the people who live in it in our series, How We Changed. Today, Catherine Green Davis from Baltimore, Maryland.
In 2008, I have been a florist for 12 years, have my own business, and with the financial downturn, my business really took a hit. My husband built sets for films, and it was a roller coaster ride for us both having contractual jobs. I came to the conclusion that one of us needed to have a steady job. So I looked over at my husband and I said, I'm going to go to nursing school. Nursing school is really hard. I went to this desk every day that had graffiti on it that said, you can do it. And I sat there with my snacks and my computer and my books, and I studied so hard.
Hi,
I live about 12 minutes from Johns Hopkins Hospital, and I went up there all the time to the recruiting office and tried to get a job, and they wouldn't hire me. And then finally I got a job in dialysis there and finagled my way into working the HIV unit. And I worked there for 2.5 years, but my dream was to work in the emergency room. And I got a job in the emergency room where I've been for 1.5 years now. The financial downturn changed my life for sure. I am so glad that I got a chance to really change my life and do a job that is so interesting and crazy and rewarding and stressful. It's given me a lot of confidence, and that is something I feel really proud about.
We've got a picture of Catherine Green Davis on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM. And while you're there, do us a favor, take a minute, would you? And share your story of the financial crisis and the Great Recession and how it changed you. The hashtag, obviously, is How We Change. If you've ever stayed in a hotel and given your bill more than a cursory look, you're familiar with the various and sundry taxes that cities and counties put on there. Room taxes, occupancy charges, resort fees, what have you. In Florida, counties tack on something called a tourism development tax, anywhere from 2 to 6% a night, which really adds up in a state that gets hundreds of billions of dollars in tourism spending every year. Collecting it, of course, is easy. Consumers just pay. It's the spending and who decides where that money goes that gets tricky. Marketplace's Renata Sago has more on that.
Stephen Sharkey is Florida grown, as they say here. He was born and raised in Brevard County, 3 hours north of Miami. As a kid, he spent a lot of time exploring a coastal inlet called the Indian River Lagoon. One of his earliest memories?
My dad coming home from work and going to collect a blue crab out of the canals.
That was back in the 80s. Today, he's not so optimistic about eating the crab here. Sharkey stands at the shore of the lagoon, shaking his head. His cap reads, Save the IRL, short for Indian River Lagoon.
I haven't fished since before Irma, Hurricane Irma came through. The lagoon is in a bad state.
During hurricane season last year, millions of pounds of raw sewage flowed into the lagoon, which spans 5 coastal counties. A 2016 study found the lagoon attracts millions of visitors and generates close to $1.5 billion in spending. But until this year, none of the revenue from the area's Tourism Development Tax, or TDT, could be spent to clean up the lagoon.
Our tourist development tax money, even though the Indian River Lagoon is the number one tourism asset of the county, could not be spent to help the lagoon.
That's Randy Fine, a state lawmaker who represents South Brevard County. He authored a bill that passed the legislature this spring. Part of the argument was roughly $4 million in TDT funds were going to clean up county beaches, even though lagoons were also a tourist draw.
If we let those get ruined, we're going to ruin the state.
But the tourism industry's worried the new law will open the door to even more demands on TDT money, which can already go toward things like convention centers and public museums. Samantha Padgett is general counsel for the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association.
You are taking away dollars that would historically go to the very thing that the tax was designed to do.
That's to promote that state as a tourist destination, which Florida voters approved in the 1970s when they created the TDT.
When the last leaf of autumn has fallen to the ground.
This ad from back then is one of the state's earliest marketing campaigns. It features all the stars of Florida's number one industry, sunshine, beaches, and happy tourists who'd fled the code for tan lines. Campaigns like these have worked over the years. Visitors spent $112 billion in 2016. Almost 30% of that, $32 billion, went to lodging that generated tourist development tax revenue. Other states and cities have enacted taxes on hotel stays because, for the most part, they're not controversial, says Tom Knight. He's director of economic development for the city of Ithaca, New York, which also has the tax.
It's other people's money. People from outside the community pay the room tax.
But as states and counties become more cash-strapped, University of Maryland environmental law professor Robert Percival says we can expect more intense debates over how to use TDT revenue, particularly when it comes to outdoor and natural attractions.
Nothing turns off a tourist worse than arriving and finding beaches are closed or there are fish kills or sewage in a lagoon.
Sure, they'll already have laid out money for their visit, he says, but they might not come back. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Coming up, the sound is going to be amazing, the picture is going to be huge, and I'm going to get a really theatrical experience.
Some old technology made new again to get people back into theaters, but first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on this Thursday. Dow Industrials up 0.2%, 54 points, 26,439. The NASDAQ added 0.6%, 51 points, ended things at 8,041. The S&P 500 up 0.2%, 8 points, 29 and 14. There was some energy in energy stocks today. CMS Energy lit up 1.2%. Duke Energy charged up 1%. On the retail front, kind of a mixed bag, actually. Ross Stores, those are the dress for less folks, they rang up a gain of 0.3%. Kohl's, also a discount chain, headed the other way, dipped more than 1% today. After 3 years in New York trying for a bigger piece of the luxury car market, Cadillac is headed back to the mothership. That would be Detroit, of course. General Motors shares dipped 0.1%. Bonds rose yield on the 10-year T-note, down to 3.05%. You're listening to Marketplace. Over the past couple of months, you've been hearing Divided Decade, our year-long project covering the Great Recession and how it continues to affect our lives. As a nonprofit news organization, we believe this kind of in-depth reporting helps make people smarter about the economic forces that affect us every single day. If you agree, please go to Marketplace.org to become a Marketplace investor and keep reliable, independent journalism going strong. And thanks.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As the NAFTA renegotiations get down to brass tacks, it's the really hard stuff that's holding things up. First of all, and most big picture, whether Canada's even going to be in the thing or not, TBD is a fair summary of those negotiations. But even in the preliminary deal the United States has made with Mexico, there are some not quite yet resolved disagreements. First among them, probably, is cars. In the 25 or so years since NAFTA went into effect, car and car parts manufacturers in the United States have sent a lot of work to be done by the cheaper labor pool south of the border. And the Trump administration is trying to encourage those manufacturers to bring it all back home. From the KJZZ Bureau in Mexico City, Jorge Valencia reports.
I'm cruising down a highway that loops around the center of Mexico City.
Vamos sobre el circuito interior.
Behind the wheel is Oscar Garcia. He's the facilities manager at a nearby plant for a company called Racini. Garcia is pointing out the brands of cars on the highway for which his company makes suspensions.
The BMW, ejemplo, la Jeep, Nissan, X-Trail, sistema de.
In many cases, these cars are assembled in the U.S. with Mexican-made components.
Es Explorer se ensambla en Estados Unidos.
For example, Garcia points at a Ford Explorer. Garcia says his company makes the suspensions, the truck is then assembled in Chicago, and exported to several countries, including Mexico. Under the Trump administration's preliminary terms with Mexico, more parts of this Ford Explorer should come from factories where the pay is at least $16 an hour. Garcia, a mid-level manager, says he makes just under $10. So will he get a pay raise, or would Ford, as the agreement says, pay a 2.5% tariff instead for not meeting the wage requirement?
If that's the case, 2.5% in a vast majority of cases is going to be cheaper than raising the wage in Mexico to above $16 an hour.
Christian Gicek is an economist with the Center for Automotive Research, a Michigan-based think tank. There are a few publicly available details about how the wage requirement would be enforced.
It's not entirely clear how they determine whether or not a company is in conformity with that rule.
Mexican government statistics show less than 1% of the country's working population earns at least $16 an hour. Manuel Montoya heads an association of car part makers in northern Mexico. He says manufacturers are unlikely to raise wages to that level.
I think this rule is more for ensuring that certain percentage of the production will be in Canada and the U.S.
Montoya says he wishes the terms were more favorable to Mexican businesses. But he's relieved that after a year of negotiations, the U.S. and Mexico are close to an agreement.
So now we can plan?
Although his plans may need to be flexible. Congress has to ratify any deal, and it's not clear whether this bilateral agreement would get enough votes without including Canada as part of a broader NAFTA replacement. The highway here in Mexico City is full of American brand names and U.S.-assembled cars. Department of Commerce figures show Mexico was the fourth biggest market for American car exports last year, after Canada, China, and Germany.
Pues también ellos van a ver que se necesita que otros...
Auto plant manager Oscar Garcia says he hopes the U.S. will realize that what's good for its neighbors is good for the American economy, too.
Como mexicanos, lo único que nos queda es seguir trabajando.
But Garcia says Mexicans should keep working hard so that their own industry will grow, with or without the U.S. In Mexico City, I'm Jorge Valencia for Marketplace.
This item today from the What's Old is New Again file. 2001, A Space Odyssey was re-released this year in honor of its 50th anniversary. And on a lot of screens, Stanley Kubrick's iconic film was shown in its original analog 70mm format. Bigger, brighter, more crisp than standard film. Also a format that's been spilling over lately from art houses into the mainstream. Everything from Academy Award-winning Dunkirk to somehow not Academy Award-winning Wonder Woman. Also, 70mm's revival has given hope to the fading film projectionist workforce, as Marketplace's Peter Ballin on Rosen reports.
Okay, so when it goes into the projector, the sound is facing...
Up in the projection booth at the Alamo Drafthouse movie theater in Brooklyn, head projectionist Tanner Agle is giving a training on a 70mm projector.
Okay. I'm hitting this green button start. I'm just going to run this a little bit.
70mm film, twice the size of regular film, means more color, more detail, more everything on the screen. It's become the darling of directors like Quentin Tarantino, Paul Thomas Anderson, and Christopher Nolan. In the past 5 years, 12 major films have been released to screen in 70mm. So, Agle needs projectionists.
It is a little hard finding people that are capable. I do find that now there's an excess of people who want to work in projection, but there's not many people who have touched a projector before.
He's teaching Genevieve Havemeyer-King how to use 70mm equipment. She is an archivist at the New York Public Library by day and art house projectionist by night.
Like goes through the other side?
Yeah, through this other side.
She's been projecting film since 2011, just not 70mm film. Theater started asking her if she could.
I get so many calls to run film in New York City because it seems like there's a shortage.
70mm film had its first huge splash in the 50s and 60s. Hollywood was competing with TV for attention and for cash. Wade Major, a film critic in Los Angeles, says it caused studios to release bright 70mm epics with one goal.
The sound is going to be amazing, the picture is going to be huge, and I'm going to get a really theatrical experience.
Films like Ben-Hur and...
The hills are alive with the sound of music.
You know, films you'd be willing to leave the house and pay for. Today, Hollywood's fighting a similar economic battle, this time against Netflix and YouTube. Directors again hope to have something you can't get at home with 70mm films.
And then you have to obviously have a projectionist who is schooled and be able to thread them up, treat the prints accordingly. That's an institutional knowledge that has faded over the last 25, 30 years.
Knowledge that Genevieve Havemeyer-King is hoping to master. We meet up a few days after her 70mm training.
It's definitely a labor of love. I don't do this for the money. I enjoy doing projection gigs where I do make enough money because, like, who doesn't love money?
Today, most of the films projectionists work with are digital, making their trade super vulnerable to automation. Almost a third of all projection jobs, digital or film, have disappeared since 2015, and 1 in 10 of the remaining jobs are expected to disappear in the next decade.
I want film to survive and I want people to be able to see film.
Ironically, Havemeyer King might get her wish from the projection booth, because 70mm film, one of the industry's oldest mediums, could be the savior for some of those projection jobs.
I want it to become normal. Like, I would prefer it to be not, like, too gimmicky, because I feel like gimmicks die off.
Ultimately, it'll be up to us whether we continue to shell out cash to see 70mm films and get to hear this sound from the back. In New York, I'm Peter Balanon Rosen for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which one can only say, aha, I knew it. An admittedly anecdotal and subjective piece of data from the letters section of the most recent issue of the journal Nature, demonstrating that those lectures and conference presentations that just bore the bejesus out of you really do go on longer than the ones that are interesting. To quote the author, for every 70 seconds that a speaker droned on beyond their allotted time, the odds that their talk had been boring doubled. You do still have to sit through them. I'm sorry about that, but now at least you know. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial is up 0.2% today, 54 points. NASDAQ added 0.6%. That is 51 points. S&P 500 up 0.2%, 8 points on that particular index. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.